If I can just sort of share some reflections for the first part and just sort of go through some stuff pretty quickly, and a lot of it we sort of have already really done, and then last night in Vespers I tried to do a little bit more of that. And then what I'd like to do at the end is really, the last part is to really talk about more as a group, and maybe at one point maybe even split up into two or three smaller groups and just talking about our own lessons and experiences from the wilderness, and try to make some connections between our own experiences and the stuff that we've been talking about more in terms of the wilderness story, so to speak. But I'll close this door. Let's just start by again referring back, and we've already talked quite a bit about Exodus 16, and I sort of moved into another phase of that in Vespers last night, really talking about what lessons I think the people learned, and talking about that of no one owns anything, that it's God's, that there's enough for everyone if we share it. You can't hoard things, those kinds of lessons that I really do think that story teaches us, and I really suspect that our own experiences in the wilderness directly can help us understand those things. So without looking back at that, at this particular point, let me just say one thing. There's another a guy named Reek, I think is, or Reich, I guess it is, wrote a book called Mystery on the Mountain and talks about the whole Sinai experience. And one of the things he does in that is refer to that whole experience as sort of almost a puberty rite of passage for a young people. If you sort of see the people of Israel as a people who are just sort of in their youth as a nation, then it sort of really applies. It's sort of like a vision quest is what he applies it to. Is that their time in the wilderness is like a vision quest of trying to come to some kind of understanding of what their identity is, which I think really translates directly into the Native American experience if you see it that way. So that's just another thing to think about. Let's look at really quickly Mark 1:1-8. I'll read. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The beginning of the gospel. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, "Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, who shall prepare thy way, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make the Lord's path straight." John the Baptizer appeared in the wilderness, preaching a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. And there went out to him all the country of Judea and all the people of Jerusalem, and they were baptized by him in the river Jordan, confessing their sins. Now John was clothed with camel's hair and had a leather girdle around his waist and ate locust and wild honey. And he preached, saying, "After me comes he who is mightier than I, the thong of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop down and untie. I have baptized you with water, but he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit." And the next paragraph is essentially when Jesus is baptized. I really think it's significant that we look at this. This is the beginning of the gospel, and where does it begin? The gospel begins in the wilderness. Some of these ideas I take from a sermon that was preached by a friend of mine, Joseph Williamson, who's the pastor of a church in Seattle. And the title of the sermon was "It All Begins in the Wilderness," and it was preached on this text. And he essentially says that it's really no accident that the gospel begins in a place that is not a safe place, that is not a tame place. That's where John starts. That's where Jesus is baptized. We talk about the voice crying in the wilderness. And what I contend, and some others would say, is that what John and Jesus are doing is essentially calling the people of Israel back to the wilderness story, of saying, that's where the covenant was. That's the those are the lessons that Yahweh taught us. But once you got into the land, you blew it. You no longer saw the land as the gift of God, as the manna, and you turned it into something that you divided and owned, and you didn't divide it equally. And John and Jesus are returning to the wilderness vision. And essentially, I would say that that's what Jesus' ministry is. And let's look at that. After Jesus is baptized, and I told you to read Matthew. What I'd really like to do, which is almost the same account, exactly, in Luke, and I'll show you the reason why I want to use that one. So if you look at Luke 4, one through 13, and the story, again, hopefully everyone did have a chance to read through this. So maybe we can just sort of summarize it without reading the whole thing. Jesus, after he is baptized, goes to the wilderness. For 40 days, he fasts, and it's there that he is tempted by Satan. And essentially, Satan tempts him in Luke, they're a little different order in the different ones, says to him, if you are the Son of God, command this stone to become bread. And Jesus answered, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone. In all three instances, maybe others don't get excited about this stuff as I do, but I really get excited when I start realizing where his references come from. In all three instances, Jesus' response are direct Old Testament references. And let's just take a second and look back at what they are. The reference for man shall not live by bread alone comes from Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. So if you look back at Deuteronomy 8, this is the response to the first Leviticus, Deuteronomy. Ow. How come I can't? There it is. Verse 3, but if you read before that verse, it says, all the commandment, which this is starting with verse 1 and going on down to possess the land. And then in verse 2 it says, and you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that the Lord might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep the commandments or not. And then verse 3, and he humbled you and let you hunger and fed you manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that humans do not live by bread alone. So if you only look at the bread alone and you don't refer back to what he's really talking about, again, it's a reference back to the manna story. It's a recalling, it's a In the wilderness where Jesus is being tempted by Satan, the response is essentially saying, my loyalty is still to Yahweh, who is in charge of everything. My loyalty is still to the vision of the manna story. The same thing is true for the other references. And you can, if you have one of these books, you can look down and see where it references Deuteronomy 6, 13 and verse 4, 8. Jesus' answer to the second one, you shall worship the Lord your God, and God only shall you serve, comes out of Deuteronomy 6, 13. And again, it's another reference. We won't take time, I think, so we can move on and get to some more interchange to look at that. But it's again, it's a reference to the wilderness. If you want to do that on your own, you can do that. Again, the final one is the same thing. It's also from chapter 6, verse 16 in Deuteronomy, which is the response in verse 12 to the third temptation. You shall not tempt the Lord your God. So, And then the reason I wanted to particularly look at the Luke passage is that immediately after Jesus leaves the wilderness, okay, he's just been baptized, he goes to the wilderness is the first thing, and then what's the first thing Jesus does after that? He goes to Galilee. In the different Gospels, it's slightly different. But in verse 16, he came to Nazareth, he goes to the synagogue, and it is there that Jesus says, he opens the book of the prophet Isaiah, and he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. God has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." So what we have is a situation where Jesus begins in the wilderness and then his ministry starts. And I think that really this is essentially his definition, his proclaiming of his purpose of coming out of the wilderness, and again tying that back to the vision, the lessons of the wilderness in the Sinai desert. That's a new covenant. It's God essentially saying, okay, we're going to try this all over again. The first covenant didn't work. We're going to find some other way to get you to go back and relearn the story. We're going to try to get you to go back to the wilderness. But the people for John the Baptist, they came to the wilderness to be baptized. The people had to be in the wilderness. Dan Erlander likes to call the wilderness God's classroom. So that's where God teaches the lessons. And I think that, you know, if we follow through, and we won't go into a lot of detail, but if we follow through Jesus' ministry, we find Jesus really, you know, maybe challenging is the best word, the Sabbath laws, throwing people out of the temple who are the money changers, those kinds of things, essentially attacking the domesticated religion of the time, the institutional religion. Again, I think saying we got to get rid of all this nonsense, all these trappings, all these ways in which we've domesticated our religion, our God, and relearn the story, relearn the wilderness story. So, I won't spend any more time on that. Are there any comments or questions? You think that's a far-fetched interpretation, or is that?
In Jesus' life, too, several times where he went off into the wilderness.
There are definitely times we could refer back to Jesus goes to a lonely place. Yeah. I mean, in fact, another instance is just before the whole story of the feeding of the 5,000, when two fishes and five loaves, or two loaves and five loaves and two fishes, okay. I never thought that made a whole lot of difference. But anyway, when that feeds 5,000 people, Jesus has tried to get away. And it says it's in a lonely place. It's some way away from town. And again, a lot of the interpretation that people have of that story is that is also a place where it's the manna story. It's this amount of food. There's enough to go around. There's enough here for everyone if we share it. And through God's power, there's enough. So there's a lot of that. Let's shift then and say, okay, then what are the ways? And we've already talked about this a little bit when we talked about how did we domesticate God. But let's just spend a minute talking about if this is true, what are the ways that we domesticate ourselves, that we keep ourselves domesticated? Or maybe another way of doing it to tie it back to yesterday morning is, what are the ways in which we obstruct ourselves from living a sacramental life, or living the vision of the wilderness? I mentioned a couple of those last night, just in terms of sort of complacency and some of the stuff. Or maybe maybe the best way to do it is, you know, what are the ways that you personally do that? Maybe none of us do that.
Well, one thought comes to me is isn't a personal way, but we build society, builds these sprawling metropolises where it's hard to get away from it all and go into the wilderness. And maybe that's one way where we make somewhat artificial parks. That's not quite the same. And that may be one way where kind of putting up barriers between us and God.
So we lose touch with creation in a sense of, I mean, if we spend all our time in concrete, then the only thing that we come in contact with are human-made structures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Some of the other ways.
But trying to avoid human pain.
Okay.
I mean, I usually win the battle about that, I think, with myself, but I always have to force myself to confront
it. Another one of my favorite books is by Walter Brueggemann, happens to be somebody I really like. He wrote a book called Prophetic Imagination, in which he talks about numbness. He talks about the way we set up our whole society and we don't know how to grieve, we don't know how to confront reality, we live in numbness, and we do everything to perpetuate that, really. It's a wonderful book related to this story, because he talks about the Egyptian royal consciousness and how that's essentially what we have now. And we haven't adjusted our way of thinking. But, yeah.
The way I domesticate myself is by having a routine that I stick to.
Okay.
Verbatim. And,
yeah.
When I become aware of it, I get really sick of it.
I think that's one of my problems sometimes too.
I think there's a balance you need, though. You need a certain discipline, mm-hmm. a structure, but at the same time you have to be flexible, adaptable to, and open and listening to things that happen within that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the routine itself is not necessarily a problem. It's when you use the routine to shut out other stuff. When you use the routine to keep you from getting off into the woods, too. I mean, that's a very specific thing.
Work.
Lots of work.
Yeah. Rush, time, yeah.
And the material stuff, getting caught up in all of just the material attention.
Mm-hmm. Thinking that that's going to be your salvation, even if it's unconscious.
To a shopping list.
What's that?
Sort of. I tend to reduce my life to a shopping list sometimes. Mm-hmm. I need this.
Yeah. You don't seem to have much of it.
Stuff that we need.
Certainly compared to the length of my list.
That's what I mean. That's what I'm talking about.
I think one of our biggest handicap frailties is still doubt.
Is what?
It's still doubt.
Doubt.
Like that story you told about the fellow falling off the cliff and hanging on to the...
Oh, right.
Yeah. How do we seek safety over risk?
Okay.
Yeah. Comfort over discomfort. Security.
Right.
Challenge.
Familiarity.
Familiarity over the unknown.
That's a real big one for me, is the safety stuff. I mean, as I was saying, the gospel does not begin in a safe place. And we can get into a whole discussion here about acceptable risk. I don't believe that you go up and you purposely put yourself in something where, you know, the chances are 75% probability you're going to die just so you want to take risks. But I really do believe that we are, I mean, look, one indication to that is the whole insurance mess in this country. I mean, we insure ourselves death. And I have real theological problems with insurance. I mean, should we as Christians have insurance? Now, that's a real question for me. I do have medical insurance.
Theoretically, no, we shouldn't.
We had a forum here at Holden a few weeks ago that a few of us put together on insurance. Well, and that, you know, because is that putting our security in the wrong place? I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have it, but when you have to have liability, when a homeowner has fire insurance, theft insurance, liability insurance, what other kinds of insurance? Medical insurance. You can have investment insurance. I mean, it's like we don't want to take any risk with anything.
Let me give you an example of something that's changing in that world, perhaps, which is maybe a human learning experience. The Disney Corporation manages its risk of being sued for liability by carrier, and it has the lowest insurance rate of any provider of commercial recreation in the United States. If you injure yourself when you're a Disney developer, Disneyland or otherwise, you are immediately cared for and cared about by anyone that's close. And you know, you are taken from both the embarrassment of public injury, which is significant, but you truly feel cared for. Well, you could say that Disney's motives are to pay low insurance, but if you listen to the instruction that they give their people, in fact, there is caring as a motive as well, that they truly see their customer as a guest, and they truly want to care about them. The result of that honesty, because I think if it was dishonest, it wouldn't work. The result of that honesty has brought them to the lowest level of need of paid insurance, liability insurance, of any corporation, attorneys, and recreation, which is an area that gets the highest level of liability lawsuits. So maybe, but turn around. In fact, we're having the Disney Corporation teach all of the supervisors in the United States to gather in one place for only the second time in our history, which goes back to 1897. And they're going to spend a 4-hour course on risk management, which is built on caring for people.
Yeah, and see, I mean, my idea is that ideally insurance, if it was a matter of a community of people, the idea of insurance is that everybody pays into a pot, and then whoever needs it is the one that's cared for. Well, obviously, that's not what really is the purpose of most insurance. But let me just read this or read parts of this editorial I referred to the other day about weather, because I think it has to do with the whole risk thing that we want everything to be planned out and safe. Three lobstermen are lost in a violent November storm that surprises them on George's Bank. George's Bank is a fishing grounds off the New England coast. A Delta Airlines jumbo jet crashes on its approach to the Dallas-Fort Worth airport as an unexpectedly severe thunderstorm breaks across the field. The toll is 134. After such losses, the tendency is to blame weathermen and air traffic controllers for what the skippers and pilots did not know. Indeed, a federal judge in Boston ruled Monday that the National Weather Service is liable in the lobsterman's case. He awarded $1.25 million in damages to the lobstermen's families because the agency had not repaired a weather buoy that might have helped predict the storm, but had been broken for several months. Travel and work on the sea is, of course, more hazardous than staying at home. But mariners today are much safer than the dorymen of the past. U.S. air travelers are safer than stagecoach riders were, and even safer than bus riders in some countries today. Still, weather-related accidents happen, and sometimes they might have been avoided if safeguards had functioned properly. Those who fly in dirty weather or go offshore in gale season know that there is a government-sponsored system aimed at keeping risks within bounds. Yet a degree of risk always remains. Anyone in charge of a boat or plane assumes responsibility for the decision to go. If a pilot is seriously misdirected, sent into another plane's airspace, or onto the same runway, negligence is clear-cut. If the information is merely incomplete, a case will be cloudier. And it goes on to talk about the stuff. It says, questions such as these are not evidence of negligence, however. The public can demand that the Weather Service be well-equipped well-manned and well-directed, but there is a limit to the safety the government can provide. Most who make their living in the air or on the sea accept that. But I think generally we want, our society is moving in the direction of wanting a completely sterile, risk-free place. And what does that do to our whole way of orientation? Are there other ways that you can think of in terms of the way we...
It seems to me the professional specialization too, right? You know, that's the category. I was trying to figure out what category I went with an experience I had this fall where I went to a funeral for a pastor, and it was an interracial affair and largely patterned in Black tradition, but I found myself imagining the body in the casket. For some reason, I mean, imagining that there was really a body. I mean, there was really a body in there, but but so focusing on the significance of the body, and it occurred to me that oh, this is going to sound bizarre because we're so patterned against this, but it occurred to me that when Clint dies, if I'm living, I want to care for the body, and that cuts against every grain of current 20th century. Practice, you know, we just turned that over.
That's part of the numbness
again.
Used to turn
over. I mean, the parallel that came in my mind was the way that we used to turn childbirth over to the professionals. Okay, knock me out, take the baby, and give it to me 2 days from now when I get conscious again. And we've kind of repersonalized that process, but we haven't repersonalized death. So that's one.
What's the movie? Places in the
Heart. Yeah, Places in the Heart, where you know, that's wonderful scene of them flying out of the body in the dining room table in the home.
That's still practiced in third world country.
I'm sure it is. I have no... Well, and the other time I had run into that was we had a very ill infant in the parish that died right after Easter this year. In reading a lot of the literature about stillborns and infant deaths, the advice to parents is that you can keep the child, you can keep the body, and you can deal with the body. You don't have to immediately turn it over. And that, I mean, it's like, it really shocks me. It's like throwing cold water in my face to read it and to run into it. But there's something, when I get over the initial shock, there's something really right about that to me. It's
we had some Cambodians in there. Well, we sponsored a Cambodian family. One of the group that came over died, and they were going to have it cremated. And Elaine was going between the whatever it is,
the mortician.
You got to tell us, right?
Well, I just had a relationship in town with one of the morticians who I, you know, made arrangements to do this at minimum cost and stuff. And so they were going to do the cremation, and the family's question that again floored me was, when and where is the cremation? We want to be there. Americans don't go to cremations.
A bunch of them showed up, you know, with kids, and you know, they took pictures of the body.
They're not set up for that at all.
They had this great big party, and the pictures of the body on the little can of ashes, and they all went out for a hike in Spokane Falls with the priest afterwards.
This is kind of
cool.
Really interesting. But that seems...
How different it can be.
But not only, you know, medically and with death and with a lot of things, we use professionals to kind of, again, to buffer. Mm-hmm.
I think that's true.
Think of the security of the telephone versus a personal letter. Harrison Keeler has recently written a short article addressing that. It's very good, but if you think about it, a letter causes you to open up and to risk leaving something open, you know, indefinitely in front of someone else.
That's
whereas a telephone, it can be as superficial and as businesslike as possible when you hang up.
That's an interesting point, because see, I live now without a telephone. I mean, not even access to one at all, and which has forced me to write more letters. And because I used to just, I am someone who likes to take on the telephone, but that's an interesting point. Anything else, Mark? Let me just mention one other real quick one, and Carl and I were talking about liberation theology today. I think another way in which we do it is that we really limit our willingness to look at different viewpoints, whether it's theology or philosophy or whatever. And we really see everything, all of us see it from a very white middle class North American perspective. Some of us see it from a white middle class male perspective, and some from female. But so that's, I don't really want to get into that one in great detail, but it's another way in which we, I think we really limit ourselves. We don't break out of our patterns. What I'd like to do for the rest of the time is in, for the rest of the formal time we have, and then we can go, is just now try to just talk for a little while, trying to make some connections about some of the stuff that comes out of the sort of biblical tradition and some of the stuff we've talked about in sort of our domestication of both of ourselves and our world and our God. And try to think of the ways in which our experience in the wilderness maybe lessons out of the biblical story too that we've already talked about. What are some of the lessons that we've had in the wilderness, and whether that was stuff that we've had in the last 2 days, or whether it's stuff that we've had before, or maybe it's stuff that we might hope to have or think that the wilderness might teach us at some point in our lives. And especially those things that might help us to break through these obstacles to the sacramental life, to break through the obstacles to domestication, to help us to restore and to maintain the sense of the wilderness. And then what I'd like to do tomorrow morning is for us to go one step further and talk about how we, when we leave here, we can work on maintaining and are retaining and sustaining the wilderness experience in our lives. What are the specific things that we can do? But right now I'd like to talk about what are the lessons that we've had in the wilderness. And I've got a couple stories I'd like to share at some point, some short ones, but I'd also like to hear from other people. So let's just talk about it. Hopefully we can pull some of this stuff together.
I want to share a little bit. We talked about risks when you go out in the wilderness, you take risks, and I just want to share how going out in the outdoors has taught me not to avoid risk, but to rely on God, to take risks, but to rely on God and leave things up to Him. We've been trying to start a hiking club, and we had an outing this last summer, and we always, before we go on a hike, we'd stop and have a prayer before we leave that God would watch over us and protect us and no one would be hurt. And we were having lunch by this waterfall. It was a real deep chasm, about 25 feet deep, and I was taking some pictures up above the rest of the group, and they started eating their lunch, so I went back to join them, and I wasn't even worried about any danger. I was walking along. I was about 3 feet from the edge of this chasm, and my foot hit a little wet place, and before I knew it, I just dove right over the edge of this cliff. And I was sure I was a goner. It was about 25 feet down. And I just was clawing the air. There wasn't anything to grab. And I spun around as I was falling. I had cutoffs on. I was sure I was just going to be all scratched up and broken bones and everything. And I landed about 8 feet down. My toes hit a ledge there, and I just stuck right there. And then I had a scratch. I just landed right on the face of this cliff. And I could just barely reach up to the top, and I was kind of shaky at that.
By you're that asking if there was anybody else up there.
Yeah, my story kind of came through. And I pulled myself back up out of there, and I was really thanking the Lord for watching after me. I've gone out in much more dangerous places than that, but I knew it was God taking care of me, that I wasn't hurt. It was, you know, I just really felt being protected by God. Yeah, it was just, I was sure I was wiped out as I was falling through the air there.
Well, this maybe I should go ahead and tell one of the stories I was going to tell, because it sounds pretty similar. That's a little different point, I guess. But I had an accident about 5 years ago now, I guess. And I was ice climbing in New England, and which a lot of people think is a ridiculous thing to do anyway. But And we just finished about 300 foot ice climb. I was really excited. I had led the climb. It was the hardest thing I'd ever led. Everything went really well. It was a beautiful day. And it's a typical story. You always, when you're doing mountaineering instruction, you always tell people there are more accidents going down than coming up, because that's when you lose your concentration, you're tired, and all those kind of things. Anyway, we were going down a traverse across some fairly steep slopes, a lot of snow, but there was a little packed out trail there some other climbers had used, and we were sort of bouncing along, and it was a little steep section that I glissade any chance I get. I think that's always the easiest and fun way to do it. So I just sort of sat down to go down this thing, and I just wasn't concentrating like I should have, and I sort of popped out of the little scooped out area there and started down the hill. Well, at that point, as I hit the edge, sort of the whole sort of thing started to slide with me, so my ice axe didn't do a whole lot of good. I wasn't even worried at that point. I reached out to just grab a tree, and I'm not even sure what happened. I couldn't hold on to it. At that point, I remember very consciously thinking, all I saw was an edge. And we had just come around some things that were 200 or 300 feet high. I had no idea it was on the other side of the edge. I had no idea. All I saw was an edge. I couldn't see anything on the other. So my immediate thought was, well, this could be 200 or 300 feet high. And I knew I was going over at that point. There was nothing I could do. And I remember very consciously thinking, well, you always wanted to know what it was going to be like to fall. And I really, those exact words went through my head, and I just completely relaxed. I've never had an experience like that in my life. It was a moment in which I knew there was nothing I could do. It was completely out of control for me. And for me to give up complete control of something is really, I mean, it's unfortunate that it took that level of crisis to do it, but that's exactly what it happened, is that I knew there was absolutely nothing I could do, and the only thing I could do was just relax. And I don't remember anything between that point and the point I found myself rolling down the snow slope. I ended up going probably 200 feet down a slope. The vertical drop was about 30 feet. There was enough snow at the bottom that it didn't hurt me. I did break 3 bones, but two ribs and my wrist was, I can't rotate my wrist all around. But I had an ice hammer in a holster. I had crampons on my feet. I had a whole rack of ice screws around my chest, and I didn't have a scratch on me. And there were some other guys that were walking right along in front of me when I landed. They came up and splinted my arm, and then it gets really funny, because it's right up above a railroad track where there's one train a week that goes by, and it came along going really slowly. We flagged down the train, and the train took me out. So I didn't even have to walk out. But anyway, the main thing about that is, you know, I'm not so much to say that, you know, what could have happened, but it was more the moment. I mean, that is, I don't want to suggest that everybody has to have an accident or go ice climbing in order to experience that, but that for me was the primary moment in my life where I felt complete surrender. And what I guess I remember that is the time where I feel like that is as close to as close an experience to really understanding what that means as I've ever had. And I really think about that moment a lot. I just very, as vividly as can be, remember thinking that and then just letting go completely. Anyway, other lessons that people have from the wilderness.
I guess I've had lots of experiences that impressed me, but with myself. But one was with another. When I was ranger on Mount Hood, a young man, about 25 years old, farm family son from Gresham was lost. And we'd been searching for about 2 days in an area called the Salmon River Canyon. And very frustrated, and it's extremely rugged country, and hadn't found him. And I interviewed his parents, and I got him aside away from everybody, and his mother told me of this dream he had. He loved to fish, and he knew he had been fishing. But he wanted to get past one more waterfall in the Salmon River Canyon. There's a whole series of waterfalls and pools, and fish it. And so I went up the canyon and repeated his climbs up the falls. I went in alone, and I found him at the base of the waterfall that his mother had told me that he wanted to reach, to pass. And he had achieved a free climb of a mossy face and gotten just to the top because we found his fishing rod up there where he had laid it. And then he lost it, and the rock and the moss was way in under his fingernails as he had slid down the face, and he was dead. But he hadn't died from the impact. He died from the combination of that and the exposure. And he had made a cairn that formed a cross from the river run rocks in which he'd fallen. And he was badly broken. He'd lain himself just in a comfort position and, you know, accepted death. And I radioed out in the radio, and I radioed up, and we couldn't, you can't reach into that with a helicopter because they're overlapping walls. And so I sat with the body for about 12 hours till we could get a cable arrest system down to bring him out. And that 12 hours, I really, you know, had that time to meditate and reflect on my own relationship, my own mortality with the country that I traveled in a solitary way, you know, all my life as part of my job and also my application. And it probably left the most long-lasting realization on me on the fact that I, you know, all these trips and all these accomplishments was always subject to the rules of the land that I was in, and never conquered anything, and nor had he. My only regret in that whole memory is that we brought him out of there. I think he would have been better where he fell.
Other lessons? They don't have to all be quite as all accidents like the first three stories we've told.
I can top any of those.
I'm just going to say, we don't have to.
This might be
much more.
Things that I reflect on many times, of course, I've had a lot of experiences from my journeys into the Philippines and the Piscata Mission, St. Vincent. I recently went there because I heard about the disastrous fire that hurt the church and the convent, and one of the Belgian priests lost his life, and I volunteered to come and do what I could. I can't. And this was the Christmas Day, Eve Day, and I had an errand in a neighboring town that's from Santiago to Medela is a one-way street, or one-way road that is very remote. It takes, it's only 56 kilometers, but it takes minimum of 3 hours to drive it to rocks and boulders and so forth in there. And of course, when the rains come up, the rivers sometimes wash out the bridges and so forth. That's happened last year over there. But this one bridge, and I had promised this was Christmas Eve, and the Christmas program starts at 9, and then midnight mass at 12, and I was going to say, well, Holy Night, midnight mass. So I knew I'd better get started, and I got small minibus, and they're overloaded, as you well know. And we came to this river, and the truck on the opposite side, the water was flowing over the bridge, and they don't have railings or anything, just the bridge with planks there. And the water was flowing about 8-10 inches over the planks are raised. But we could have made it across with the bus, except a truck on the far side had missed the approach and the front wheels were off, thus stopping all traffic. It's getting dark, rain coming down there, and everybody piles off the bus, and people take their shoes off and put their stuff on their head, and they got up and start shuffling across, and I started the same thing. Here I had just arrived more than 2 weeks before that, and this elderly female woman, and I'm sure his father said, we're not going to do that. And of course I became an imposter as soon as I came, because they thought I was the replacement of the Belgian priest who lost his life. And now jokingly they still call me father over there. But anyway, I was going to go, and she said, no, that's it. Well, I said, you're going to do it. Oh, that's different. We don't want to lose you. I thought about the priest who lost his life. So anyway, I said, I got to sing at Mass and sing at the community program and this. So I went across, he held on to me. There's no way if I went, and could see he hold me from going over, but I got across, and then my long legs, and I was bound determined. We were 13 kilometers away from Modelo, and that's approximately 9 miles. And it was 7:30 in the evening already. No way could I make the community program. But I figured maybe midnight mass. So I started out, and the rain coming down. Soon I lost the others because of my long legs. I was bound determined to make an all-out effort to get there. And just out of nowhere, I heard a noise behind me. Here come a motorcycle. And he pulled up and he says, Father, you're going to St. Vincent? I said, yeah. He said, no problem. I said, jump on. I'm talking about it. So I got a motorcycle the way I went. I got there in time to take even a warm bath for it. And so it looked to me, it means that the Lord provides. No matter what. There's so many things.
On a smaller scale, it's something that happened just today. You told us about the pass out to the Beaver Pond, how the trail takes a radical right turn, and it's most people's nemesis. Turned out to be mine too. And took a pretty good head first fall into the snow, and it wasn't the only one of the day. And as I was headed back, I was complaining to Rebecca. She was saying, "Are you having a good time?" I said, "Yeah, it's really neat, but I wish I wouldn't fall so much." And she said, "Well, that just means you don't like being out of control." And that was really brought it right home to me about how much I got to be in control. And every once in a while, you don't have control. You got to give it up, and that's when you can learn something. When you give it up,
good luck. Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Yeah.
One story. Back to yours.
Yeah, and I think those lessons can be learned in other places, but I do think that the wilderness is a place that put this away, and which is a special classroom, as I was saying before, for teaching us those things.
There's a story I want to talk about, but it isn't really my story, except with what I did with it. And that's a story that we all know about, and it's really hard for me to talk about still, which is the story of the group on Mount Hood. The priest and the kids from the school had died. Tom Goldman was a friend of ours, and he's the leader of the party. And his brother John read scripture at our wedding. And we attended the memorial service for Tom. And we had kind of sat in vigil. It was a kind of extended network of people all during the search time. Sat in vigil, sort of waiting for word from the party, and Tom had done that for years. And all of us, the kind of extended network of people, have taken kids out into dangerous situations. and understand that to be an important thing to do, a redemptive thing to do, a transforming thing to do. And so, you know, it touched, I mean, it was just a lot on the line, I think, personally for me and the whole thing. And I don't, you know, I don't even know, I can't make a judgment about the decisions that were made on the climb, and that's not the level at which it's important for me to deal with it even at this point. But the thing that, there were a couple things that happened. The memorial service, no reference was made to the circumstances of the death. No reference was made to anybody dying but Tom, which seemed real domesticating to me and really dissatisfactory. Granted, it was a really difficult thing, I think, for all of the participants, but it was really dissatisfying to me. And then I had a conversation during the following week with a woman in my church who was trying to be supportive of the grief that many of us were feeling. But what she said to me was, yeah, I'd never let a kid of mine go on a climb like that. Which was not the response I wanted. And it wasn't like, because some accidents, mistakes, whatever, because tragedy occurs, my response, I don't want to make the response of choosing utter safety. I want to, and I wouldn't choose for my kid utter safety in that situation. So I was kind of trying to sort all that out, and I did devotions for a kind of minister support group and used that as an opportunity to put some of my own thoughts together. And the only kind of thing that I could make come out of it for me was that whole story as a metaphor for ministry, where the mountain becomes the place where heaven meets earth, and it's a dangerous place. And as a minister, I need to be willing to walk with any who will go there and to risk that danger. And that's that has kind of focused for me some of my own experiences, none of which particularly come to mind to tell, but also to somehow understand and to re-derive the importance of, you know, the legitimacy of doing those things, of taking people into dangerous places. And saying that it's important to take people into dangerous places. It's also important to be careful and to use good judgment when you do that. But that was a great moment.
Yeah.
Either it's a dangerous place or it's not. Either you could all die or you couldn't all die. And so if there's any... I've obviously thought a lot about that thing too.
Yeah, I think our tendency is to think that if you do something and something happens, that it was a foolish thing to do to start with, instead of saying that sometimes, maybe, you know, it was maybe the decision to go. Maybe there were some bad decisions made, but sometimes, you know, maybe. And I think that's true.
And if you get foolish enough to think that because it's been done 20 times, it can be 21 without taking caution, then you forget that it's a dangerous place. And it still really is a dangerous place. And in fact, that's why you keep doing it, is because you want people to have an experience.
And Tom Gorman would have been the first one to tell you that, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. That one of the more sobering thoughts I had during all the many thoughts during that period, was that if there was one, you know, if I was going to, and I want very much for my kids to have that kind of an experience, an understanding of that sort of physical challenge of danger and contingent nature of life, and the need to risk that for an encounter with infinite things, you know, the wilderness stuff we've been talking about. If I couldn't imagine a better place or a better person or a better group than that.
Send a kid up.
If, you know, just knowing nothing at all, I would have gladly.
Give a kid to Tom.
Without thinking. So there's what your judgment. There's your risk management.
Let me make an interesting point about that rescue, which I was not involved in, of course, but the 52 that I was when I was right here in Long Beach. That the copy in the newspaper in that case, and in the ones I was involved in, when there were the few that were fatalities, was that the mountain killed 9 people. Mount Hood is a killer mountain. And I always reflect on the many people that I've known in my life that have died in car accidents, and never have I seen the coverage accuse the car of being an assassin.
You know, when Mount St. Helens blew, I was in New York City, and the headline that I saw said,
"This is a wilderness."
said, "Killer ash cloud headed for New York." New York is the center of the universe.
Well, there's some real insight into domestication of our animals, about nature, when you really think about that, that we take the, we transplant the blame.
I have an undomesticated funeral to talk about.
Okay.
I just thought of this. This is about 5 years ago. I'm a fisherman. And one night, Puget Sound, a real bad night, 20 miles up the sound from me, I lost a friend. And we didn't find out until the next day. We don't know what happened. His boat swamped and he was overboard. And that evening we went fishing. That's just what you do, you're fishing. And you talk about it on the radio. And it, somehow you just, you know, you don't think about, can it happen to me or not, or what happened. It happened, and you talk about it like, it, you know, you discuss it very objectively, and it just doesn't apply to you. But that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is...
You're a commercial fisherman?
Yeah.
Oh, the, so this thing I read just, yeah.
The funeral that weekend was at Port Townsend, and it was planned by his friends, fisherman friends of his and his wife, and it was really a tearjerker. It was earthy, and it was, you know, and they discussed fishing. They didn't gloss over anything, and it was really heavy. And when they finished the funeral, they carried his casket half a mile down the waterfront and put it on a boat and took it out the straits and gave him a water burial. And everybody went down the waterfront and you know, just said goodbye to him. It was hard.
Sort of like what you were saying about leaving the...
They better leave me out there or I'll come back and home.
But, you know, you learn about death. It's real.
Well, I had kind of a disappointment this year, and I wasn't able to go out as far as I wanted to with the dirt because I got very cold feet. And, well, I had gotten cold feet yesterday, so when I got back, realized how cold it was. And so when we were beyond the baseball field, and I realized they were really cold and I needed to come back. I think it all has to do with the fact that I had open heart surgery and they used veins for my legs for the bypass. And consequently, I just don't have enough circulation. So that's something now that I have to remember. Either get electric socks or something like that.
They do make them, I think.
Yes,
they
do.
Blessing that you could go out far enough to realize your feet were closed.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. It's bad without veins, but it's hard without a heart.
We've gone just about an hour, and I don't. And if there are those of you who are just fighting every second to stay awake or something. I don't know. I think we ought to just say, don't feel like you have to stay. I'm quite willing to sit and talk for a little while longer and talk about this or other stuff that more people want to talk. But let me just say that now, and I will not be offended in any way if people need to get up and go to sleep. And we can meet tomorrow morning at 8:30 and wrap things up. And let me just say that if you do have ideas, and we can go back to this after I say this, but if you do have ideas for resources that might be helpful to other people, if you could think about that and bring those ideas tomorrow, maybe even write it, if you could even write it down ahead of time, that'd be helpful. I'll take those. And some people have already asked me about some of the books I've referred to, so I'll be glad to just type up a list of anything that I get from you, plus the stuff I've got, and send it back out. So.
Can you be sure and let us know where the Merton citation, the citation for the Merton quotation?
I don't know where it came from. Somebody gave me that. I'll make a copy for it.
I was going to ask you after tonight if I could just even reread it or.
Yeah. I'll write.
Yeah, Nancy and I put our things up too up there on that table. Some of the things, you know, you can write down things to get this stuff. Some of it's out of print, some of it's old. So take a look through this stuff and see some copies of other stuff up there if you want to help yourself too.
Okay.
You made a note to yourself about making copies or I was going to ask you if I could just reread it.
Sure. How many people would want a copy of it? I won't make any more than I need.
Is there a participant list coming out?
Four. I'll send that out with the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, well, just about everybody then. All right. Actually, on the same page, there's that thing from Walking Buffalo about the talking to trees, so that I read to both groups. So I'll just copy the whole page and you can have it. Let me just make a couple sort of wrap-up comments for this, and then we can continue talking like we were for those of you who want to stay. I guess just some things that I've reflected on in terms of lessons. One of them that has specifically to do with some of the biblical stuff we were talking about, that if you look at some of the psychology around passages in our lives, very often there are three stages and major transitions or passages in our lives. And the first one is disengagement from the established and normal routines, or the uprooting of our lives. And the second one being waiting in the nowhere, or waiting in the gaps, is really even a word that I've heard specifically used in that context. The waiting between what was and what is to be, and then finally moving into the third stage of returning to some kind of a new identity, a new sense of purpose, and a new sense of reality. And I really think, you know, you could do a lot of work around that with wilderness experiences, of really seeing wilderness as a place of re-identification, of being uprooted to become rerooted. And I think that can be in a very general sense in some of the stuff we looked at, but I think it can also be in a very specific sense, so that we need to get out in the wilderness, literally, in our own lives, to break through some of the normal routines. Not that all those routines are always bad, but that we need to break them to keep our perspective, and that part of being out in the wilderness does that, because it is not the same routine as I have anywhere else. It is different. There's no doubt about that. We've already talked about taking risk. I think that really is important. We've talked about vulnerability in a sense of surrender and not being in control. I really also think that there really is something about lifestyle, and that really comes back to what Nancy and Bev were talking about tonight. I really do think that there's a way in which the wilderness teaches us simplicity in a way that we really need to carry back to the rest of our world. It teaches us simplicity. I also really do think that the wilderness can teach us some of the stuff out of the manna story. It can teach us that there's enough to go around. In an indirect way, perhaps, but there's enough out there. I mean, when you see the in the wonder of it all, what is stuff that Elmer was talking about tonight, I mean, we need that sense of wonder in our world. We've lost it. That's the domestication. Domestication takes away wonder. And being back out and skiing slowly and looking for some of the stuff like we did today reacquaints us with that sense of wonder. And related to that, and this is the last thing I'll say, I would have to say that one of the things that climbing and being out in the mountains has done for me is rekindle passion. And I really think there's a connection between passion and compassion. I really think, I've got a long way to go, but I think I'm a more compassionate person for being out in the mountains. I really believe that. I think that there's a way in which all those things we've talked about sort of all tied up together somehow or another, break through some of the numbness that you were talking about. It helps me to, I mean, I have to be in touch with and concentrate in ways when I'm climbing that I don't have to in other ways. I have to be much more in touch with my fears, much more in touch with my sense of wonder, much more in touch with my sense of just awe. In a way that I really think helps me break through some of the pain. And there's a real passion about being. I mean, what are the things that you do that you know you're going to do the next day and you can't sleep the night before because you're so excited? I mean, for me, that's climbing, a lot of it, or skiing or whatever. You know, I mean, not all the time. Sometimes I'm up because I'm scared to death. But some... But a lot of it is really passion, and I people around Holden have heard me quote this story several times, but I am very fond of a particular scene in The Chariots of Fire, which is a movie that really hit home for me. I don't know, how many of you have seen that? Most of you probably seen it. I think I've seen it I saw it three times in 2 weeks, or something like that, and I very seldom go to movies a second time, especially not right after. But the whole story there, I mean, for me, I really deal a lot with sort of competition and what that means in my life, and having been a real jock when I was in high school and trying to sort out through some of those issues and trying to find the sort of the creative part of competition without it being a real destructive force, which I think it unfortunately often and usually is. But anyway... there's a scene in that movie where, for those of you who didn't see it, it's about two runners in the 1924 Olympics that were held in Paris. They're British runners. One of them is the son of missionaries from China, and he's from Scotland. He comes back to Scotland with his sister for his education, and they're working in a little mission church in Edinburgh. And he sort of just starts sort of run. I mean, he just likes to run, and he runs for training. And somebody notices him and starts training him for races. And he's incredibly good. And so he just starts sort of entering the little local competitions, and he starts winning everything. Gradually, somebody takes more interest in him, and he's all of a sudden on the British Olympic team and getting a lot of attention. Anyway, his sister, Jenny, is just getting disgusted with this whole thing. She thinks it is a completely frivolous thing and a complete waste of time for him to be going off running when God's work is to be in this church all the time. So finally, he comes in late for a service that he was supposed to help with one time. He's been out training, and she has just had it with him. And he comes in, and she's very angry, and he says, look, let's go for a walk. So they go up outside of the city, and they're up on some of the hillside up above the city. And he says, okay, Jenny, he said, I have something to tell you. Oh, I should tell you. She's been worried that he's going to leave, you know, church work altogether. And he says, well, I have something to tell you. He said, first of all, I want to tell you that I have decided that I am indeed being called to go back to China as a missionary. And she gets all excited and jumps up and down and hugs him and says, oh, well, great. I knew you would finally see the light here and give up your running. And he said, wait a minute. The second thing I have to tell you is that I've also decided that I am going to go to the Olympics. And he says, you have to understand that God gave me the gifts to be a speaker and to preach and to be a missionary. But God also, and with incredible passion in his voice, he says, but God also made me fast. And he says, and then he says, and when I run, I feel God's pleasure. When I run, I feel God's pleasure. And that line always has hit me, because so often we always so concerned about feeling God's displeasure. We're always so concerned about maybe God's pleased about something, but I've never thought of it in terms of feeling God's pleasure in something. And that has really become a metaphor for what I use to try to explain a lot of times what I feel when I'm skiing or climbing or just hiking. That there's a sense in which I feel in harmony and I feel God's pleasure, and there's a real sense of passion and I think compassion that comes out of that. And the wilderness really taught me that. I really believe that. I really think that if I had never gotten into mountains and being outdoors, I don't think that I would be as compassionate and passionate as I am. Not that I'm the world's most passionate, compassionate person, but God knows what I would have been like if I hadn't had that experience. So, coming right back to where I first started when I told you on Friday night that, you know, one of the reasons I do this stuff is because I try to make the connections between I was talking to a couple of people today that one of the things I will probably end up doing when I leave Holden is going to Central America for a year. And there's a connection there for me, and I think that's some of where it comes from. And there's a connection in what I see Jesus doing and trying to reclaim the wilderness vision and saying, I've come, I've been anointed to preach good news to the poor, to recover, to restore sight to the blind, to free the captives. And I really do think that there's a vision out of the wilderness that we have to reclaim in our world. And that there are lessons there that we need. And part of that is to return to the wilderness, to be able to read and understand the wilderness, and to be able to let the passions of the wilderness fill us and let us take them back to wherever we come from. So, I'll end with that, and people who want to hang around, let's talk some more. I just want to, since I'm the leader, I get to get my last 2 cents in. So, those of you who want to, you know, who need to leave, feel free. Good night.
Where's the fall? Where is all that go?
What's that?
Like the words of Paul there in Damascus Road. Lord, what would you have me do?
Right.
What is all that do? Great funeral. I can't do it.
You mentioned something about if people are interested in hearing about outdoor ministries, how you feel about it.
About outdoor ministry. Well, let me think. Where would I want to start with this stuff?
Yes.
Do you have particular?
It was, you know, a Christian type of thing. We pray first, but then we just recreate. We didn't really
So maybe I just need to go back to it with mm-hmm. more direction. And,
yeah. Well, I don't know how much you want to hear from me. I could talk a long time about this. Might not say anything, but I could still talk about it. I taught high school and did youth work for a total of about 10 years. And part of that time, I was the associate conference minister in Massachusetts for, which included outdoor ministry. So for several years, I was did that for state, the United Church of Christ. And so it's something that I've really struggled with, and I have led trips to with kids and adults. And I guess I find one thing, I mean, there's a lot of stuff, but I think that most people assume that youth don't want anything to do with spiritual stuff. And that is just not right. That is totally untrue. Most of them are dying to have some kind of... The problem is the way we package it. And it is true they don't want anything to do with sort of a packaged, you know, list of doctrines and rules and that sort of thing. And I think one of the problems is that our whole Christian education approach is not one, it's domesticated. I guess I'm overusing this word, but it's very canned and limited and boxed in. And basically, my basic gut feeling about why is because most of the people teaching it themselves don't have a faith that really allows them to explore and question and raise all sorts of doubts. My feeling about doubt is that doubt is an integral part of faith, and if you don't have it and question things, you're not going to get anywhere. That doesn't mean doubt isn't the same as disbelief. It just means that we're honest enough about saying that we don't have absolute certainty. So I don't, you know, I think there's a lot of things we can talk about in terms of Christian education, but I guess and sort of a brief response would be, I think then that, I think I said the other night, my approach to dealing with youth a lot of times is to assume that they already have had and will continue to have spiritual experiences. In other words, moments in their lives when there is something that points them towards the transcendent, the divine, in their lives. And then my role as a teacher, educator, minister is to start by trying to help them recognize that and to help them make meaning out of it and try to connect those things. And I think you can do that outdoors about as well as you can do it just about anywhere. So, you know, I don't think all the trips I've led have been, you know, always the greatest experience of these kids' lives, or that they always went perfectly well at all. But I think if you start out by not apologizing for, you know, how many youth leaders have you seen that come up and it's sort of like, well, okay, we gotta pray now. I mean, that's the way it's done. It's sort of like, well, we have to apologize for this, you know, okay, but we have to do this because we're a church program kind of thing. That's sort of the attitude, instead of getting excited about stuff and getting them involved in it. And I think when you do that, and as I was saying the other night, you'll have them asking for 30 minutes of silent prayer and a real time of understanding that. And when I've led week trips, my co-leader and I will lead the first evening sort of vespers around the campfire. And after that, the kids do it the rest of the week. And we'll bring some resources perhaps and we'll help them with it, but they'll do it and they get excited about it if you just help them and don't sort of say, okay, you have to do it this way and you have to have Vespers. It's an orientation, it's an attitude, it's an openness to letting them express, and by guiding them by saying, okay, what are the experiences that you've had today that make you more aware of this or of God's presence? Or that's all very general. I don't know if that's maybe connecting.
There's a major problem between outdoor ministries and wilderness, because first of all, they are large groups for whatever efficiencies are desired in many cases.
Yeah, see, I won't take large groups.
And I know, and they seek recreation.
Yeah.
And therefore they get recreation. When in fact wilderness, you know, is defined as a resource, you can argue about the reasons. but it's done to separate it from recreation. And we manage it not as a recreation resource, but as a wilderness resource. And we control size of party for that reason. Because the most important words in management to us is opportunity for solitude. And where else are you going to find it? And so we always require permits now, and we always steer them out of wilderness unless we're dealing with somebody like Barry that we know is dealing with small party, and we know that is using wilderness on an organized basis for a ministry that is seeking wilderness and solitude, and not a recreational spirit. I mean, you may have a nice fun time out there, but that's not recreational. You know, I have a fun time doing lots of things, working. But it's a major problem. We also find, just like we do with any of the youth movements, like the Scouts, we find an abundance of ill-equipped leadership.
Yeah.
People with good intentions and bad results.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And see, when you said that you wanted to teach an ethic, so that's what we expect. That's exactly what our ambition would be, is that mm-hmm. you were teaching an ethic and they were learning an ethic.
And I think the best way to teach that is by simply doing it yourself, but also not just doing it yourself and then letting them do it. I mean, I make it, when I've led trips, we together on the first night draw up a covenant, that I call it, in which they all agree, and they form it. I mean, they make out the list of things that they think are important for that week, that's a matter of how they're going to live together. Now, but before we do that, I also make it clear that there are certain parts of that covenant that they have the right to make and change themselves, but there are certain ground rules that aren't negotiable. And because of my responsibility for the group. And part of those non-negotiables are that there is a certain kind of ethic about the wilderness that we as a group will take responsibility and make a commitment to. And that, you know, we go over some of those things the first night, but then there's things that you teach along. And if you explain to a 16-year-old why you're doing that, most of them aren't going to rebel against that. I mean, they, you know, there's good reasons for it. Is that where you're at? I don't know. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I think it's just the attitude that people have of me. You know, that it's there for us.
Yeah. Well,
and I can't break through it somehow unless I figure out how.
My experience, I did a little bit of consulting with some other outdoor ministries program after I was sort of in between jobs before I moved out here. And my experience is that in most outdoor ministries program in different churches, and this was at least two different denominations, is that they really don't have a clear sense of purpose about their outdoor programs to start with. And if they do, they have a much better sense of purpose about the camp programs than they do about the adventure programs, the off-site stuff. People don't really know why they're doing that other than it seems to be a good thing to do. And very often what happens is that you very, very seldom have really well-trained leadership. You have almost always volunteers, in summer programs, and that's not bad at all, but then there's no, at the conference or synod or district or whatever denomination, judicatory you're talking about, level, there's not good training programs to train people. And so what usually happens is, this is oversimplifying, I know, but you usually have either somebody who is a perhaps pastor or somebody who's a Christian educator or a youth worker who may be really good at religious education, but whom, you know, I wouldn't trust my kid with in the mountains because they simply don't have that kind of experience. So you have either that side of it, and maybe they can do some stuff educationally, but they don't really know how to do that outdoors, and especially when they're sort of lost control of the group anyway sometimes. Maybe not. I'm exaggerating, but okay. Or you have somebody who is a really good outdoors person who really is very experienced with that, but doesn't really know how to do any religious programming, how to retranslate that. And I think my approach is that you do a little bit of sort of routine in the evenings, and you definitely have a worship time, and we would have some other kinds of discussions. But a lot of it is just hanging loose and doing what we did today, which is recognizing things as you go along, trying to then draw that out. And the main thing we did every night was we had just simply reflections on the day. And the first night or two, they might not talk very much. Usually by the third night, I was falling asleep because I couldn't shut them up. You know, I mean, they were just talking and talking, and they'd recognize this and they'd see that, and they had this experience, and then it's a matter of using your sort of skills as a facilitator just to draw things out of people, and then making comments and trying to help them interpret those things. That to me is a much, it's a matter of being intentional about the spiritual side of it, but of doing that intentionally, flexibly. By not having a whole lot of really specific, you know, rigid sort of curriculum kind of stuff, but and having some of that. And I always carry, like, there's a few stories that I always carry copies of with me that we'll use during the week, and a few things like that. So there are things specifically that you bring, and you know, you always throw in a few little fun things like cremation of Sam McGee and some of that stuff, but. I always read Barrington Bunny. Do you know that story? That's one of my favorite stories. We just did that. I did
do
a children.
Do you cry when you read Barrington?
Not anymore. I for
you
children's
domesticated Vespers. It.
Yeah, that's right. 2 weeks ago, I used that for. We did a children's Vespers here after Christmas. It's a great story. I'll let you read it if you want to. It's a little short story about a rabbit, but it's one of the best stories on grace and interdependence I've ever read. It's a children's, I mean, it's not a children's story, but that's the way we think of it.
It's a good bedtime story to a kid.
Oh, it's great.
It's yeah. A real character.
It's a little sad because the rabbit's sort of a Christ figure and gets dies saving a field. Yeah, in the snow, saving a field mice. Anyway, I'm talking a lot. Do other people have ideas, or are other things you want to talk about?
I guess I have a question on my tip of my tongue to ask you guys. It's relevant to what we said. Were there any lawsuits after that?
You know, I wondered if
episode.
You don't know yet. They only come the last day that they're eligible to be filed. Yeah. That's always the thing.
There
are two. There are two parents. That's the beginning.
Two parents are suing. Yeah.
And that might well be, and this really relates closely to what we were saying, one reason why there was no mention of the circumstances or anything about that at the funeral at the Memorial Service, too. And I could well imagine some lawyer for the school said, all right, we're just not talking about this stuff.
They're suing the school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The school.
And you know, well, I guess I'm stalking again.
Yeah.
You really better don't get me started.
Yeah.
On that one.
That one of the See, that has a ripple effect because that affected every outdoor program in the United States. I was director of a wilderness program that summer, and I was scheduled to lead. One of the main reasons that I sought that job was because they had a permit to take trips up Mount Rainier, one of the few permits.